A globally operating alliance of powerful public and private actors is going even further. They're working towards creating a transnational digital identity for everyone, which would include all available data about each of us. The alliance wants everyone to just use biometric data, like our faces, irises, and fingerprints, to identify ourselves, and also to give permission for personal data being used. They promise that each individual will have complete control over their own data. But according to critics, that's nonsense. They argue that the concept of transnational digital identity is paving the way for total and global surveillance. Dakota Gruner, head of the organisation ID 2020 in New York City, says the management of identity still falls woefully short around the world.
Identity is a human right. Each of us needs the ability to prove who we are in the eyes of the law. We need it as a fundamental enabler of getting access to healthcare, to financial services, to so many vital services.
250 million children don't have a birth certificate, she says. Millions of refugees have no documents. On the internet, there's a proliferation of virtual identities that online scammers and child abusers exploit to the best of their ability. At the same time, law-abiding citizens suffer unnecessary checks, Gruner says. And this lack of efficient identity controls costs the global economy hundreds of billions of dollars each year. ID 2020 wants to change that.
ID 2020 believes that the future can be different. This public-private partnership is dedicated to solving the challenges related to identity in today's world.
To do this, it's backed by high-tech companies, including Bill Gates' Microsoft and Accenture, the Rockefeller Foundation, and major aid organisations such as Mercy Corps, CARE, and the Gates-funded Gavi Vaccine Alliance. Chief Executive Gruner says the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is also a close partner.
You know, at the moment, 1 in 7 people on the planet are unable to prove their identity through any recognized means, which means that significant numbers of individuals are unable to access so many of those services. And so it's our belief that everyone deserves a form of digital identity that's privacy protecting, that's user controlled, is portable and is persistent.
Digital identity, a collection of data about us stored using the latest blockchain technology. A blockchain is essentially a digital ledger of transactions, duplicated and simultaneously stored on countless servers around the world. It records data under a pseudonym and in encrypted form. And with the current technology, it's very difficult, or even impossible, to hack, manipulate, or delete data saved this way. Because every entry builds on the existing blockchain. This secure system is also used to trade the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, and Gruner says it's ideally suited to the needs of ID 2020.
We're thinking about it as an amalgamation of different credentials or different attributes. What we're trying to enable is that everyone has the ability to collect those different credentials and collect, you know, verifiable proof of those different attributes. And so you could imagine that somebody has a digital certificate from their university, or has a proof of their vaccination, or has proof of, you know, their credit score or employment information.
Like the US government, the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, is also taken with the idea of making a digital identity available to all. In 2019, the EU outlined its sweeping ideas about digital identity in a report by its EU Blockchain Observatory.
A digital identity is the sum total of all the attributes that exist about us in the digital realm, a constantly growing and evolving collection of data points. These could be verifiable credentials, but could also be data from a social media account, a history of transactions on an e-commerce site, or attestations from friends or colleagues. There really is no limit.
Dakota Gruner stresses that, unlike in many national systems, everyone should have access to all their own data. If a bank, a landlord, or a border guard want to know details about you, you should be able to use a smartphone app to provide only the information you want to make available. Everything else stays hidden. This is what's known as self-sovereign identity. Gruner stresses that ID 2020 doesn't want to compete with national systems of digital identity. Rather, it seeks to complement them. So if a country wants to use the ID 2020 scheme, it can link its system with that of transnational digital identity.
The Known Traveller Digital Identity, or KTDI, is a public-private collaboration.
One example is the Known Traveller Digital Identity Project, or KTDI. It's designed to make paperless travel possible worldwide. The initiative from the World Economic Forum involves the governments of Canada and the Netherlands, airlines, airport authorities, hotels, as well as credit card and car rental companies. As with all digital identity projects, those who participate will first have to have their biometric data, mainly their faces, stored in the system so that they can be recognised at checkpoints. Christoph Wolf, head of mobility at the World Economic Forum, explains that travellers also provide other personal data to increase trust in the system.
The key areas, of course, are who you are, where you live and things like that. Past travel history or credit card history can be saved on the blockchain. And once the system's been in use for a certain amount of time, past border crossings will, of course, also be stored. That increases credibility because you can provide more validated data.
Passengers using KTDI can look forward to a pleasant, hassle-free journey, Wolf points out, at the airport, when they pick up the rental car, and when they check into their hotel.
When the traveller arrives, they can identify themselves with their biometrics, for example, their face. Different bits of information are merged in the background, and in 99% of cases, the traveller is classified as trustworthy, and they can then pass through the particular checkpoint without standing in line or being checked.
So it's no big deal if you forget your passport. A KTDI pilot project is due to start in early 2021 with passport-free travel between Canada and the Netherlands. A separate international initiative set to begin in March next year aims to make it possible to travel with a digital identity between Britain and mainland Europe. Registered users on the Eurostar high-speed train that connects London with Paris, Amsterdam and other cities on the continent will no longer need an ID card. Instead, when they arrive, they'll simply pass through a biometric corridor lined with cameras. Meanwhile, the organisation ID 2020 is also working to provide digital identities to disadvantaged people in developing countries. For instance, they're registering the face, iris and fingerprints of refugees from Myanmar who are being housed in Thai camps.
What we've done is first portable electronic health records that allow somebody to turn up at any of those four clinics so that they can receive the correct care. But we've now expanded that to the livelihoods program so that the individuals who've received these types of trainings have verifiable credentials of the training they've received.
This new digital identity, packed with important documents, should help put refugees on firm footing once they leave the camp, Gruner says. ID 2020 also has a similar program up and running in Bangladesh.
The project in Bangladesh is a project that we're doing with the government of Bangladesh and Gavi. And this is really around digital immunization records and digital identity. In Bangladesh, only 20% of kids are receiving a birth certificate by their fifth birthday. And yet almost every child, well over 90% of children, are receiving their childhood vaccines. There was an opportunity both to strengthen the immunization system by having digital records where you could track, had a child received all of the necessary booster doses, but also that we could leverage a well-functioning immunization system as an entry point for digital ID.
A vaccination certificate as the starting point for a biometrically based digital identity. That's an idea they're also now promoting in an entirely different context, that of the current pandemic.
When you think about the COVID-19 pandemic at the moment, there's a really important question about how we resume normal day-to-day life. And some of that hinges on how can somebody prove they have had a recent negative test or that they, down the line, have received a COVID vaccine.
ID 2020 partner Bill Gates called for just that in an interview, saying proof of a coronavirus vaccine should become a prerequisite for cross-border travel.
Eventually, what we'll have to have is certificates of who's a vaccinated person, because you don't want people moving around the world where you'll have some countries that won't have it under control, sadly. You don't want to completely block off ability for, you know, people to go there and come back and move around.
That would mean cameras at immigration control or even at the entrance to a soccer stadium that read your face and determine whether or not you've been vaccinated. That kind of technology could soon ensure that only people who have been inoculated can enter certain shops, work in open plan offices, or attend classes at school. In this brave new world, travel would be more convenient. Those previously excluded would have access to basic social services, and authorities would save paper, time, and security personnel. But what about the other side of the coin? What impact could a transnational digital identity have on the protection of our personal data? Here's a closer look at a few points that worry critics of digital identity projects.
Collecting too much data.
According to the EU General Data Protection Regulation, personal data can be collected and processed for purposes that are clearly specified, and only to the minimum extent necessary for those purposes. Collecting and storing a wide range of our data for general administrative purposes, as planned by the ID 2020 project and backed by the European Commission, would appear to directly contradict this regulation.
Properly deleting data.
You're listening to World in Progress on CILU 102.7 FM.
The Basic Data Protection Regulation stipulates that stored personal data must be deleted as soon as the specific purpose it was collected for no longer applies. It also has to be erased if people revoke their voluntary consent to have the data stored. But you can't delete data on a blockchain. Dirk Fox owns an IT company in the southwestern German city of Karlsruhe.
A blockchain is essentially a digital account statement. And as with account statements, the balance displayed isn't from individual entries, but rather the sum of the entries in the account. As soon as you delete data, the signature mechanisms which link the elements together and prove the entries haven't been altered no longer work. It's similar to tearing out a statement from a collection of account statements. You also no longer know whether the balances are correct because you can no longer recalculate.
Accountability.
According to the Basic Data Protection Regulation, the responsible authority is liable for the proper handling of personal data. But such a body doesn't exist in blockchain-based data processing. It's just the automatism, which can't be controlled once it's set in motion.
Mass surveillance.
The biometric data generated during the creation of digital identities are also utilised as raw material for the use and further development of facial recognition systems.
Elphys Watch is a video-based facial recognition system that can be used for monitoring crowds in cities, transportation hubs, on campuses, at border crossings and more.
These kinds of surveillance systems, which are being developed by the French armaments company Thales, for example, are getting better and better. And they're already a part of everyday life in Chinese cities. That'll soon be the case in the UK as well. The German Interior Ministry has also been experimenting with the technology at train stations in Berlin. But in none of these cases, there's been talk about the consent of the people affected by the surveillance systems. That's something that worries ID 2020's Dakota Gruner.
I think what's really important when thinking through biometrics is really consent. You know, we're very concerned about use of facial recognition technology for surveillance because that's done, you know, without the active consent of the individuals involved.
Weak regulations.
ID 2020's digital identity project envisions releasing your data to entities that ask for it only if they absolutely need it, and if you agree to release that information. But Tom Fisher, a data protection activist at Privacy International in London, says that's simply not realistic.
Be able to selectively disclose information about ourselves. Well, that sounds great in theory, but often what they're ignoring is the power relations that are inherent in any kind of identity check. You know, if your employer is demanding, you know, piece of sort of data about you, if your landlord is making these kind of demands, you're perhaps not in a position to say no.
And without even realizing it, you may also surrender data that can be used against you. Dakota Gruner says that's no problem.
There is regulation in place at the moment around what can be asked of somebody sitting at a border and what, you know, cannot be asked. I don't think there's any reason to believe that with digital identity, you know, somebody would be, you know, able to ask for more information than they had been able to ask for previously.
That's true. But US border guards, for instance, are already allowed to search our smartphones. It's likely that they'll also be able to search our digital identity whenever we want to travel to the US.
A breakdown in privacy.
Clear rules would be needed to prevent companies and governments from taking arbitrary actions when dealing with transnational digital identity. Every authority would have to know what they're allowed to ask for. The answers might even have to be automated so that respondents don't volunteer too much information, either accidentally or under pressure. Security expert Dirk Fox doesn't see that happening. The interests of the governments that would have to agree to such rules are simply too different, he says. Most governments are hungry for data and see data protection as an annoying inconvenience. In reality, argues Fox, it's the market, the needs of companies, UN agencies, governments and consumers that will shape the rules surrounding digital identity.
These mechanisms are already being put in place and there are basically no discussions about what exactly they entail and whether they make sense. That's actually what gives me a headache. The so-called normative power of the factual sets in, which means at some point, certain standards and procedures will be established, which then simply become fact, which consumers can no longer ignore without being excluded from certain services.
Security risks.
ID 2020 promises that the blockchain with our digital identity will be safe from hackers and that no government will be able to siphon off our data through the back door. Dirk Fox says that's an illusion. Our digital identity will collect data throughout our lifetime, over the course of decades. But who knows today what hackers will be capable of in 2034, let alone by 2054.
Every IT system can have a back door. From the moment data gets put inside, it can get out, quite simply. And there's a very clear trend in all industrialized countries that intelligence services are increasingly getting access authorizations to these systems with corresponding laws. The Americans are ahead with the Cloud Act, which even allows them to access data that is stored on servers of US providers overseas.
Evil New World? Despite the potentially devastating consequences from a human rights and data protection perspective, the massive transnational digital identity project is making progress. The prospect of boosting efficiency is simply too tempting for governments, companies, and international organisations, even if it comes at the expense of privacy and freedom. We all might face the reality of this in the near future, say with a coronavirus vaccination campaign involving voluntary facial recognition that then could exclude non-vaccinated people. The network of commercial and governmental surveillance in the name of digital progress is getting stronger and wider. Meanwhile, we ourselves are feeding this network, sending gigabyte after gigabyte of personal data via our devices to all kinds of companies, with serious consequences, explains Fox.
These data are bound to points in time. In other words, if someone had access to all this data, it would be possible for them to track almost all of our daily behavior from these traces which we leave behind. every movement. Our car logs how loud we turn the radio up. This could be correlated with a traffic light changing. So this information can be combined to form a complete picture of our daily lives, of whatever we do or don't do.
And that information swiftly ends up on government servers. Security authorities in the US tap what Google, Apple, and Facebook collect. The European Commission, which once initiated data retention, now wants to oblige social media platforms to also search encrypted messages for evidence of child abuse. And that'll make it possible to search for practically anything, a virtual house search without cause or warrant as part of everyday life. IT companies and governments are using crises like the current coronavirus pandemic to introduce new surveillance technologies. Take China. It's dramatically increased its monitoring of citizens during the outbreak and is unlikely to ease this surveillance once the pandemic is over. Meanwhile, a number of coronavirus detection apps for smartphones have been launched in countries around the world. Germany's warning app in itself is deemed to be harmless by data security experts. But according to Dutch IT professor Jaap Henk Hoopman, the Google-Apple platform installed on practically every smartphone and which the app is based on could turn our phones into a, quote, global mass surveillance tool. Security expert Dirk Fox paints a picture of a future that may not be too far off, a future in which operators of the digital identity system have enough tools at their disposal to monitor all of us, completely. And then, he says, as in the film Minority Report, algorithms could come into play, systematically monitoring and diagnosing our behaviour and using that information to make projections.
Stellen Sie sich vor, man misst jetzt auf einmal.
Imagine measuring the amount of time that a person looks at a small child, and if they cross a certain threshold, then they're suddenly a paedophile. The danger is incredibly high that such data will be used as circumstantial evidence to make evaluations about people, and then to make predictions about their behaviour. And in this way, we rob our society of a very important element, the free development of our own personality. And we're heading into a state where everyone is under surveillance, but without it being a surveillance state in the traditional sense.
A state in which democracy too would only exist on paper. Say, a politician becomes inconvenient. It's plausible that embarrassing data could be dug up about them at any time to put them under pressure, make them more pliable. Gerd Gigerenzer, a professor of psychology based in Berlin, has been researching the psychology of modern mass surveillance, as well as decision-making under conditions of uncertainty. One phenomenon that promotes this kind of increased surveillance and monitoring, he says, is the so-called paradox of privacy. The fact that people voluntarily disclose the most intimate information about themselves, even though their privacy is actually important to them. Many people are also fostering a culture of surveillance themselves, Gigerenzer says. They might monitor their children using GPS, check their children's smartphones, or probe their child's little secrets with the help of the spy doll Hello Barbie. He also brings up China, where the government is currently collecting the DNA of all 700 million Chinese males as part of a push to better fight crime. There are also pilot projects underway that use facial recognition systems fed with the faces of convicted felons to establish the physical traits of a criminal. The idea being that you can see faces to identify potential criminals in the population. And there's the Chinese social credit system. Every Chinese citizen today has a social credit value, calculated by artificial intelligence from available data about them. Those with a bad score aren't allowed to fly. Their children can't go to a good school.
It's been reported in China that many people are now cutting ties with friends who have low social credit value, and that many young people are already listing their social credit value when they place a marriage or personal ad. Those who don't, well, then that might raise questions. The interesting thing is that, according to the few studies that exist so far, the majority of Chinese believe this is a just system, because the good citizens are rewarded and the bad citizens are punished.
Other authoritarian states are now buying China's well-functioning surveillance technology, says Giga Renzer. And that's a concern.
We could find ourselves in Western Europe surrounded by countries that are suddenly flourishing, where everyone is equal socially and functions similarly, because otherwise they'll be punished. And then the question is whether democracy can survive this development, this digital autocracy, especially when we have so many citizens who actually prefer everything that's convenient, no matter where that leads.
Peter Ibler, a consultant for digital rights at the Giordano Bruno Foundation in Berlin, runs a blog on human rights in the digital sphere. He compares the emerging surveillance society with a glass prison, complete with star-shaped cell wings, glass walls, and a watchtower in the centre with walls made of mirrors. Guards aren't even necessary in this system. Ibler says that more and more people are feeling the pressure of commercial and state surveillance. But the slide into a monitored society is so subtle, so gradual, and the threat from digitization is often so difficult to separate from the many benefits that citizens don't know what to do. There are a few data protection experts like Dirk Fox who urge everyone to delete, delete, and delete, but there's no mass movement for data protection. Yet Ibler still has hope. He hopes we won't sleepwalk into a surveillance society, that we'll wake up before we embrace a transnational digital identity, something he describes as extremely dangerous.
I believe that we're only now beginning to realise what we've gotten ourselves into, and the rules are being negotiated now. We might have the feeling that it's already too late, but right now, especially in Europe, there's growing awareness that we don't want totalitarianism, this data totalitarianism, and we instead want to insist on the principle of self-determination. And what we need is pressure from society to make room for these demands, because if that doesn't happen, then there's nothing that will protect us from the kind of surveillance situation that's already reality in China.
That report about digital identities was compiled by Thomas Krochem. The presenter was Natalie Maller. Thanks for your interest. You can listen back to this and other editions of the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or dw.com/worldinprogress. We'll be back next week. All the best from the studio team here in Bonn, Germany, and from me, Anke Rasper. Be well and take care.
CILU is supported in part by the students of Lakehead University, our sponsors, and our listeners. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Campus Tech, located in the tunnels across from LUSU at Lakehead University. They are the only Apple-authorized service provider in northwestern Ontario. They also offer educational pricing on dozens of items, as well as a wide selection of computer and gaming accessories. Stop in and chat, or check out stock and order online at campustech.ca. Magnus Theatre, bringing a revolutionary season of live theatre to northwestern Ontario. Get your 2019-2020 tickets by visiting magnustheatre.com. The Argus, Lakehead University's student newspaper. Available on Wednesdays during the school year, around campus, around the city, or online at theargus.ca.
CILU now presents Living Planet.
DW Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Charlie Shield.
I'm Song Yadin.
And this week we're bringing you something a little bit different from our usual programming. Here in studio we have with us our DW colleagues, Neil King and Gabe Borrowed, from the DW podcast On the Green Fence.
Hello, hello Charlie.
Thanks for having us.
Sonia. Hi,
hey.
Neil. You're still around you?
Yeah, you're still here.
So this show is running in the last week of the year, when many of us are thinking about end-of-year traditions and no doubt reflecting on the last 12 months.
Yeah, the holidays, Christmas time, and, well, in my household when I was a child, our traditional Christmas meal was ham. How about you all?
Well, I grew up on the other side of the world, so it's summer in December, and when I think of Christmas, I think of fresh fruit.
Beef.
Duck.
Christmas dinner, beef.
Duck.
Neil and Gabe, actually, you guys have spent the last few months, several months, diving into this very question of meat eating for the latest season of On the Green Fence. There was one concept in this season that you kept referring to throughout.
Yeah, I noticed it too. Again and again, these words, the meat paradox. Mm. What is that about?
Basically, the meat paradox means we love animals, we have them as pets, we've got a very close relationship to animals, but at the same time, we eat them and treat them really badly, especially in factory farming.
The meat paradox, the way I understand it, is the feeling that you have when you're doing something you know is wrong, but you just keep doing it. So, like, I'm 37 years old, and I've been eating meat my whole life.
Because it's so good. It tastes good.
It tastes ridiculously good. It just feels right to me.
Right, this cognitive dissonance.
Apart from the idea that animals have to die for it, and I love animals.
Okay, so this conflict. And as part of this series, you spoke to a vegetarian priest who preaches about the virtues of giving up meat. What was his name?
Rainer Hagenkort. And he's based in the Münsterland. And just for all the listeners out there, the Münsterland is basically the Silicon Valley of Germany's meat production and factory farming. That's where it all happens. Four of the five biggest companies in meat production are based in that area.
Which I find a very weird term, honestly, like Silicon Valley of meat production.
It means it's the big time companies. The big players are there. And on top of that, it's a really Catholic region. And then you've got Rainer Hagenkort, who's vegetarian, who preaches about the intrinsic value of every single animal, all the pigs, the cattle, the chicken, the turkey, that they all have a value. And you can imagine how that's not really going down well.
And he runs something called the Theological Institute of Zoology. Is that right?
So we went there to interview him. It's like literally going to a Catholic seminary. Mm-hmm. And then there's a petting zoo there.
Sounds awesome.
Let's give it a listen.
Does it surprise you that you take this so seriously and that others in your role as well don't? Because I can remember back when I was 17 years old, I had a religious mentor, Mr. Graham, and he was someone who, for me, embodied Christ. And then he had me over for dinner one night and put a big, fat T-bone steak on the plate. And I was thinking to myself, this guy's telling me this whole time to imitate Christ, the nonviolent one, to sacrifice for others, don't kill innocent beings. And then he puts a big, fat steak on the plate. And
hast du das gesagt?
No, I didn't. I didn't say anything. I didn't, but I was thinking it.
But wait a minute. How can we be so sure that Jesus didn't eat meat? Do we know that?
I'm not saying whether Jesus ate meat or not. I'm saying that he stood, we're sitting here looking at the cross. How is the pig at the Tönnies factory not like that? The pig at the Tönnies factory is just as innocent as Jesus was.
Absolut. Also das eine, was du fragst, ja, ich wundere mich manchmal über meine Kollegen, dass die das nicht aufnehmen, dass sie damit nicht umgehen können.
First off, yes, I do wonder about my colleagues sometimes. Why they can't see it like I can, why they can't deal with this topic. But I must say, in their defense, many of my fellow priests are so swamped with work to keep their churches alive that they simply don't have the time. As to your question, Neil, whether Jesus Christ ate meat, we know he took part in the marriage feast at Cana. Also, according to the scripture, after the resurrection, he and his disciples caught and ate fish. So there is no evidence from the Bible that Jesus was vegetarian. However, what did Jesus eat at the Last Supper before he was crucified? Keep in mind that it was during Passover, where all households were bound by law to slaughter a lamb, not for food, but as a religious act.
Das heißt, das Schlachten des Lammes ist keine Produktion von Lebensmittel, sondern ist immer, und da hält das Judentum ja auch dran fest, das Schlachten von Tieren ist immer ein religiöser Akt.
Jetzt, a form of sacrifice as well.
Ja, jetzt wird's aber spannend, weil was hat Jesus denn im Abendmahlsaal genommen? Brot. Brot.
Yes.
Kein Fleisch.
And here's where it gets interesting. What did Jesus eat at the Last Supper? Bread. Bread, not meat. Gabriel, you asked about Jesus and the slaughter of innocent animals. By refusing to eat lamb at Passover, Jesus takes his place in the line of the great prophets and says, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." But the significance of this is more than just symbolic. It's also historical. Back then, the temple in Jerusalem during religious festivities was like a modern-day slaughterhouse. If every single family had to slaughter a lamb, can you imagine how many animals died during Passover? Feasts like this meant that priests inside the temple were up to their knees in blood. And business was booming. Religious coffers overflowed. All of Jerusalem lived from the wealth provided by ceremonial slaughter. So it's no big surprise that when a man from Nazareth showed up and said, "What you're doing here is blasphemy. I don't believe in a God who is pleased with such sacrifices," he had to go.
Wir glauben an keinen Gott, dem diese Opfer gefallen. Und deswegen musste er weg.
I'm sorry that I'm going to bring this down to a somewhat mundane level, because we're in this world, you also have a boss, your bishop. What kind of feedback do you get from him? Do your sermons sometimes, you know, rock the boat a bit inside the church? What have you heard from him?
Absolut. Also, der Bischof hat mich ja für diese Arbeit freigestellt und er dankt auch.
The bishop has officially given me the green light to do this work, and he has thanked me for my efforts to reach people in the way that I do. He has thanked me. But in the same breath, he's told me I'm a thorn in his side. Apparently, farmers and lobbyists for the agriculture and meat industries have made formal requests for my suspension and for my salary to be taken away. And also, the bishop tells me that many people are leaving the church because of me, and that has him worried.
Weil meinetwegen offenbar viele Menschen aus der Kirche austreten. Und das macht ihm zu schaffen.
Why do they want to leave the church because of you?
Weil ich sehr deutlich mache, erstens, dass auch wenn wir von Puten, Hühnern, Schweinen und Rindern reden,
because when we're talking about chickens, turkeys, pigs and cattle, I make it very clear that each and everyone has its own intrinsic value. And that the basis for this is Bible. These animals are not alive just for us. Now, if your listeners don't know this region, let me paint a quick picture. There's more livestock here in the Münsterland than anywhere else in Germany. And on top of that, this is a very Catholic area. So there is essentially no church group or board that doesn't have a representative of the meat industry on it. How do you think these people react when they hear of a priest asking about the intrinsic value of chickens and pigs? Perhaps even worse is the idea of what people working in the slaughterhouses think when they hear my message. A woman once came to me, and this was very moving. She said, "If I even utter the sentence, 'Pigs are God's creatures, they have dignity,' then I can't go back and do my work. But I have to."
Wenn ich mit dem Satz, "Meine Schweine haben eine Würde," in meinen Stall gehe, kann ich die Arbeit gar nicht mehr machen. Aber ich muss sie machen.
For this podcast, we are going places where we wouldn't really want to go as meat eaters. We're going to see animals being slaughtered. We saw animals being slaughtered. We're going hunting. There's going to be a lot of guilt added to the guilt we already have. In a chapel sitting here like this, how do we deal with this guilt if we don't want to give up on meat?
Help us.
Yeah, help us, please.
Nehmt sehr viel Kontakt auf mit Tieren. Schaut auch, was eure Kinder erleben, wenn sie mit Haustieren zu tun haben.
Seek contact with animals as much as you can. Watch how your kids interact with them. Pay close attention to this. My two donkeys have filled me with the awareness and strength not to see them as objects of the meat industry. Use this emotional connection to try and understand that the same kind of connection could be made with a pig. When I'm with my donkeys, I know well they have emotions. I know they are aware. And I understand they're like my brothers and sisters. And ultimately, I will say, I don't want to eat my brothers and sisters.
Dann kommt mir die Geschwisterlichkeit der Tiere immer näher. Und dann werde ich irgendwann sagen, ich möchte meine Geschwister nicht mehr essen.
That was an extract from season 3 of DW podcast On the Green Fence. And here in the studio to talk to us about it, Anil and Gabe, the hosts and creators of the podcast, you both said that it was one of the most moving interviews that you've done.
I think there were two reasons why this was so emotional for us as well. And as you probably heard just there, there was one part where actually Rainer, he was, you know, his voice was cracking and he was crying. He was openly crying in front of us. He's in a real conflict himself because he's only a vegetarian, not vegan yet. And he realizes, you know, if you'd have to avoid all suffering of animals, you'd have to go vegan. And we contacted him, or we looked at this particular angle, realizing, okay, the Catholic bit might put people off. But for us, the ethical dimension of how we deal with animals, why we eat animals, and how we deal with the guilt started with the question, do animals have a soul? And if they do have a soul, should we really be eating them? You know, it was a very simple question that we started out with. And that took us on this whole sort of Christian journey towards Rainer. And I think Rainer answered a lot of questions for us in a way that we felt it. We didn't just hear it and believed it. We actually felt what he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't have to be as abstract as the idea of, you know, do animals have a soul? But what the discussion with him did for me was it connected me with the love I had for my dog that I think I had forgotten about. And eating meat all this time, I never thought about the animals that I was eating in the way that I used to think about my dog.
Yeah.
And that was the point that was driven home talking to him that day in Münster.
Was this the first time that you were really confronted with that?
Weirdly, sadly enough, yeah. I mean, I'm 37 now, and it took me this long to make that connection. That is a sad fact, but that's the way it was.
Well, I wouldn't say for me that it was the first time, but it was the first time that I really seriously talked about it, you know, because it's something I think everybody is kind of aware of. It's like a dirty secret, but you just bury it. You eat meat and you sort of just bury the consequences of what you're doing.
Well, I was really struck by this part that he said about connecting with animals. And like you were talking about with your dog, I had a cat that I loved so much. Like personally, I feel like there is intrinsic value in animals and plants and nature. And I don't feel like you even have to believe in God for that.
Mm.
Right. It's not necessarily religious to connect with animals and nature and perceive them as having a soul, perhaps.
At all. Like, it doesn't necessarily need to be. Another part, and Charlie and I were also chatting about this a bit, just the meat lobby and how powerful that seems to be, especially maybe in this context.
We heard in that episode, in that extract, that there have been formal requests for his suspension from meat lobbyists. Is he in trouble?
And what does that say?
It sounded, you know, what it does that sounded say? Like it. According to what he said, the bishop has been able to deflect those demands or claims from people in the region. But it didn't sound like he was, safe.
No, it didn't. But I mean, if you think about it, you know, people actually leaving the church because of that. There's so many reasons to leave the church these days, you know, so many scandals. But they pick on this particular priest who is preaching, actually, it is a message of love. You know, he's not preaching against people, he's preaching for the love of animals.
He's speaking truth to power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key, is that the meat lobby is so powerful.
It sounded like he was a Christ-like figure, you know? Jesus speaking out against the slaughter of the lamb during Passover is a little bit like Rainer Hagenkort speaking out against the slaughter of hundreds, millions of innocent animals on a yearly basis in the Münsterland.
And they want to crucify him for it.
That was really new to me. That was something that I had not heard before. I did not know that in the New Testament, Jesus had taken a stand against meat eating.
And now we're going to learn something else new. We're going to hear an extract from another episode of On the Green Fence, where you guys meet a hunter and watch her and her partner gut a deer. Please stay tuned for this one.
You're listening to Living Planet on CILU 102.7 FM.
Welcome back to the second half of our Living Planet Christmas special. We're here with the hosts and creators of DW podcast On the Green Fence, talking about meat eating. As part of this season, you guys went hunting.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, first off, it was the first time we did this, yeah. So it was something we were actually interested in from the outset. But also to answer the question of the meat paradox, for me personally, one of the ways out of this conundrum that we face with factory farming and industrial meat would be hunting, because those animals are free. It's more of an even playing field. They've got a chance of getting away. And I was wondering, is this maybe a sustainable way for people to eat meat? And just how scalable is it in Germany?
Yep. So we got in touch with Alina Steinbach, who is a hunter who, yeah, she does not eat meat unless it's been killed in the wild. That was her stance. That was her solution to the meat paradox. And we spent a night with her.
In a high seat.
Yeah. She didn't end up, because I was so loud in the high seat, she didn't end up shooting a deer, but her...
You scared them away.
Her boyfriend did, who was hunting simultaneously in a different part of the forest, the Felserwald. Yeah, you guys can check out what happened when we were cutting that deer up.
Yeah, let's listen.
Hey, Max.
Hello.
You just shot this deer, right? It's huge.
Yeah.
Max has strung it up, and it's... If I put my arm right up, it's still higher than I am.
Is it still warm?
Sure, you can see it heating.
Let me just touch it. God, that feels so weird. It's still warm.
Let me try.
It feels like my old dog when I would pet it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's opening up the rib cage now. That's what you can hear.
Yeah.
Now it's cutting right down. Oh, and now what's this coming out?
The bowels.
The stomach.
Mm-hmm.
A big grey mass. Okay, and you can smell it now. There's a very distinct smell in the air. Okay, now you're pulling over both sides. Oh, now it's all coming out.
Oh, man.
So within a span of about 3 minutes, you've removed the stomach and all the intestines.
Yes. Now we have like the, we say stones in our hunting language. Die Hoden.
Gonads.
Yeah.
And this has to be done immediately.
Yeah, you do it like right after the shot or half an hour later.
Why?
Because in the moment the animal is dead, the stomach bacteria start to move around the body and go to the meat. So you need to bring that out of the body to take care of the meat.
So let's just go into this box here, because Max has taken out all the intestines, the organs, and he's put it in this box.
The stomach looks like a stuffed turkey.
It does a bit. It does a bit.
With the plastic bag around it, it's completely white. Yeah. The stomach.
So this is the lung, and this is the liver, and where we have a knife. A moment. So.
What was that noise?
It's just because there's a hole somewhere in the stomach and air is coming out.
I thought there was a baby deer in there.
No. Jesus. That's like stomach inside. That's disgusting. And this is the disgusting smell here.
When this deer was walking around, Max...
Yes.
How long did it stop before you shot?
Yes.
Was it just...
It stopped and looked to me, and then I have shot, and then it's go down.
And when you saw it, did your own heart start pumping?
Yes. If your heart is not pumping faster when you are hunting, then you should stop hunting, because then it's not emotional anymore. And you need to be emotional so that you... Yeah, be concentrated, that you have a feeling for the animal, and if you're doing it like maybe a slaughter in a slaughtery, because you do it like 200 times a day, I think it's normal for them. But killing an animal or a wild animal is never normal for a hunter. Yeah.
So what is the next step? Do you leave it here overnight, or do you have to put it somewhere cold? Or what
yeah,
happens?
We put it in the freezer. In the fridge.
In the fridge.
Yeah. And we cut off the legs because the full body is too big for the fridge. Yeah, it's hard if you see the first time, I can imagine.
Oh, the noise as well. Breaking of bones.
But there's no feeling inside the body.
Waren 9 Stück insgesamt. Und dann habe ich geschossen.
There were 9 altogether, 8 does and 1 buck. When I shot the buck, it went down immediately. And when it was dead, I walked over and sat with it for half an hour.
Ich saß schon erstmal eine halbe Stunde daneben, ungefähr.
Ja. You said that you sat in a half hour together with this animal after it was dead.
Yes.
Why? What?
It's respect and the moment and the emotions and
come down.
It's been a couple hours now, and the way in which you just disemboweled it and cut off its legs, I don't see that emotion, and it's almost like a methodical hitman style. How can you do this so?
Nach einer halben Stunde.
After about a half hour, we still treat it with very much respect. It slowly starts turning into food. It died an honorable death, and we honor it by eating it. It is changing character from something that's living to food. And now we will process the meat.
Von einem Lebewesen zu einem Lebensmittel. Und jetzt geht's um die Fleischverwertung sozusagen.
Now it's being loaded onto a wheelbarrow.
It's a lot easier to grab the meat in the supermarket, or than see an animal with head and eyes.
Okay, so we're taking it inside now, in the wheelbarrow, into... Is this also... what is this?
Well, this is just a place where we can put our fridge. It's from the city here, from the village.
It is now hanging on a hook in this fridge. How long will it hang like that?
5-6 days.
And this was how many kilos approximately?
I think around 70.
And you'll be able to eat that for?
This could be for 4 or 5 months.
That sounds as if we're getting into territory where it's sustainable. Not for the mass market maybe, but if you've got, you know...
Yeah, mass market. In my bachelor thesis, I counted all the meat or the venison meat we have in Germany in 1 year, and if we all just eat venison, we have like 30 grams per year per person. It's not a lot.
So then the solution, if looking at in a world of where meat eating would be sustainable, would be for people to reduce their meat consumption. That's the only way.
Or half of them go vegetarian and the other half go hunting.
For example, yes.
So we've just heard another extract from On the Green Fence, a deep dive on meat eating. Those sounds of the stomach wheezing, that was pretty raw. Most people, they don't see that these days, at least in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just the wheezing of the stomach. How about him ripping apart the arms and legs?
Right. What was it like watching that?
It went so fast. Like, we got there and he had it hanging up, and probably 5 minutes later, the entire thing was disemboweled. It had been, you know, loaded onto a wheelbarrow, was hanging up. It went so fast.
We literally heard every step of that, and that, yeah, violent, I think, was the word you said at some point.
It was more than violent. It was carnal.
Brutal.
It was absolutely brutal, and I was in a state of shock. Watching someone so easily, it was easy for him to do that.
But Neil, somehow...
I can't do that. My DNA is a different one.
You had a different experience. You felt you had some more distance there.
Yeah. For me, the whole experience, it wasn't as... for Gabe, I think it was really traumatic. But for me, this experience was far more natural. It felt far more natural than, for instance, standing outside the meat factory where we were in Reda-Wiedenbrück, outside one of Germany's biggest meatpacking plants, Tönnies.
And every 20 seconds, a truck comes by with pigs loaded on it, and you could smell the pigs. It smelled of urine. It smelled of fear. And these pigs, they were just had minutes to live.
They were squealing in a way where it was uncomfortable for them for a long time.
Mm.
So the torture that they went through is a lot different than the deer who just got capped. He was gone in a second.
Meat eating, it has this huge ecological footprint. The animals are mostly treated really poorly, and biologically, humans, we don't need meat to survive. So there are people who believe it's immoral, like that priest that we heard from. But maybe there's a better way to eat meat, and that's kind of what we wanted to ask or discuss.
That was the point of the podcast, right?
Mm.
So we wanted to look at different people who, in their own way, solved this meat paradox. Like, how do I deal with the question, do I eat meat or not?
Let me ask you, because Gabe, I have learned that you have since become vegetarian. Is that right?
I have not eaten meat since September 9th. That was actually kind of a funny story. It was the day after the hunt with Max and Alina, and I accidentally got bacon. Eggs with bacon in the eggs.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it when he did that. He says, Neil, I'm going vegan today. He comes back with eggs and ham. I said, what happened there? He said, I didn't see the ham. I said, what about the eggs?
That was the last time to answer your question, Sonia.
Yeah. What about you, Neil? I mean, so how has this experience changed you? What are you coming away with?
Well, the main thing that I've agreed together with my family, with my wife and kids, because we also talked about this, I involved my kids also in the discussion, and we've decided now we're not buying any supermarket meat anymore whatsoever, and we haven't done that ever since. And the other thing is, here at work, for instance, in the canteen, I don't eat meat here anymore, which I used to do on a regular basis. Mm. Those are sort of the two things. And we made some contacts. I think, you know, there's also a shop just around my corner where I can buy venison, which is from my local forest. So it's got a very low carbon footprint. It hasn't got any transport or nothing.
So for you, the environment was a big thing?
That for me was the big thing that I hadn't really confronted yet. The figures, when we were doing the research on this whole story, I did not realize just how much destruction I am causing by what I'm putting on my plate mm-hmm. in other countries, not necessarily Germany, but in other countries.
Let me throw a general question out there. What are you guys eating for Christmas?
That's a very good question.
Personally, not meat. I'm not sure what my extended family is going to have or what the family is going to have, but I'm not going to eat it if it's meat.
The fact is, meat will be on the table for a lot of people this Christmas. For you guys, for those listeners who are tuning in to the podcast on The Green Fence, what's something that you want them to think about when they're listening to it?
One message right away is that we are not trying to convince anyone to go vegetarian. It's not ideologically based, or I'm not on a mission here. The point is to think about what you're eating and the impact it might have on animals, on the people working in the industry, on the world. Neil?
Yeah. All I can add is we need more love in the world. Happy Christmas.
That I can get behind. So that wraps up our show for today. You can find On the Green Fence wherever you get your podcasts, as well as more episodes of this show, Living Planet.
Thanks to our studio techs, Felix Heinzelmann, Jürgen Kuhn, and Gerd Georgi. And thanks to our guests.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for listening. Make sure to tune in next week for more environment stories from around the world. I'm Charlie Shield.
I'm Sonia Dean.
I'm Neil King.
Gabe Borod.
Bye for now.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
CILU is sponsored in part by the Students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship, an inclusive spiritual community promoting a compassionate, just, and sustainable world. Find them online at luf.ca, on Facebook, or at 129 South Algoma, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. The Live from the Rock Folk Festival, bringing the spirit of folk and folk music to Red Rock every August. Keep up to date with upcoming happenings and buy tickets online at livefromtherockfolkfestival.com. The Outpost, Lakehead University's pub, full-service restaurant, and live music venue. Find them on Facebook to stay up to date on all the happenings during the school year, like Tanker Tuesdays and Pub Night Thursdays.
CILU now presents Indie Beat.
Thanks for joining me for Indie Beat. I'm Mae Wandinger. As we look forward to a new year of great indie music, I'd like to take a couple of episodes to look back on some of the standout music of 2019. In this hour, we'll hear the first 11 of Indie Beat's top 22 songs from the last year and the artists telling us about them. First up, Steph plays the postscript, talks about Lights.
Lights is actually a song that was pretty inspired by Fleetwood Mac. I was listening to a lot of Fleetwood Mac at that point, and we have, where we live, we actually overlook the entire city of Edmonton, which is pretty awesome. And I was writing this song in the middle of the night, and everything was extremely quiet, which we don't really get here very often. And I'm not sure, it was just a song that really just came out. It talks a lot about depression and going through rough times, but always finding that light at the end of the tunnel and being able to continue. But that, yeah, it was just kind of a song that just honestly just came out very quickly.